This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley. Next month, it will be 30 years since CBS fired Tom and Dick Smothers and yanked their hit variety series off the air. The Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour was pulled not for low ratings, but because the network considered so much of their material too controversial. Here's a typical taste from the final season, with Tom Smothers playing a character about to marry a woman played by black singer Nancy Wilson.
But Celeste, aren't we forgetting about one thing that people are sure to talk about? And something that they will try to destroy our relationship, and which will cause immeasurable damage to our children?
Thomas, what are you talking about?
The fact that I'm white and you're black.
I'm what?
Tom, who plays guitar, and Dick, who plays bass, are still out on tour, and they've done plenty of other television over the years. Their classic Comedy Hour shows were rerun for the first and only time by the E! Cable Network in the early 90s. I talked with Tom in 1997 and asked him how he felt those old Comedy Hours held up after so many years. He was a bit ambivalent.
I felt that the success of the Smothers Show and its impact was based on the venue, the actual time and place and the emotions, and there was a middle of the Vietnam War, and Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy had been assassinated, and there was right-wing, left-wing, hawks and doves, and it seemed to me, and it bore out for me anyway. When I saw them, I kind of cringed. I still wanted to edit them a little bit and make them a little bit better, and I thought that playing daily out of sequence lost the impact, and I was afraid that maybe people who remembered the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour so fondly would have been disappointed to see them out of context and say, well, that wasn't like I remembered it, like going back to your high school or your junior high school and say, this school isn't as big as I remember, the old house.
But people got to go back to it when they were rebroadcast on E! In the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And even at those things, you and your brother, Dick, did these wraparound tapings, putting everything into context. And you even there looked to be, on most shows, having less of a good time than your brother did. I mean, was I reading too much into that, or were you...
That was very astute. Yes, I was having a miserable time. I started off looking at each tape, but there was 72 of them. Finally, I just went brain dead on it. And there was things I wanted to tighten up for the showing, because I had to take some time out to put the wraparounds. And over those 20 years before they were shown again, I'd watched them, but I always felt it was a little too much applause. And then I would I think that maybe we could have spoken better, could have expressed some of the ideas better. But I seem to be an exception to that. A lot of people liked them.
Well, yeah, I was going to try and find a nice, polite way to say that I think you're nuts.
That's what my brother said.
Yeah, because... I mean, when it comes to the 60s, you really can't find anything on television that boiled it all down into one lump than the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. I mean, the sexual revolution, the drugs, the rock and roll, the peace movement, the generation gap, anti-authority, mm-hmm. It's all right there. And yet you did it without losing the core audience that you started with.
No, that was an exceptional thing. Mason Williams was a great contributor, and the process was really fun. We never quite had a chance to, I always thought to do the craft better. And that's probably what I'm thinking about. Someone told me Bob Newhart was looking at, did an interview with him, and they're playing some of his old albums back. And in fact, his first album, The Button Down Mind, he says, God, I can't stand that. Don't play it. And he says, why? It's great. So, well, they took some of the pauses out to tighten it up, and that's not my timing. So I don't think anybody who's ever been a writer or a performer or a musician has recorded or published something hasn't looked back at their earlier work with a more critical eye.
When you got the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, didn't mm-hmm. you get the opportunity of creative control because you were basically going into a no-lose time slot like someone would today going in opposite Seinfeld?
Pretty much. We did a half-hour situation comedy just before that, the season before, 32 shows. And I was very unhappy with the writing, and they wrote for Tommy Smothers. I did most of the lines. Dickie was basically ignored. And I was working too hard. So when we got this new show, they said, we'll give you a variety show. I said, well, I want creative control. I said, you got it. I said, that means the content and writer approval and all those cast and people. And they said, yeah. Because there was no chance the show was going to make it anyways against Bonanza, so all the shows had been failing. So they were very cavalier and very flip about it. Also, there's no reason not to grant us creative control because we had shown no inclination. We were short hairs. We were clean cut. They didn't expect anything that happened. I don't think anybody at that time in the mid-60s expected the expression of dismay over the war and voter registration, all these things that were just taking place, and sexual revolution, all those things. So,
well, were you just laying in the weeds? I mean, did you have this grand plan?
I had no plan. I think most people don't have plans. Sometimes do something extraordinary. I got censored, so I started saying things that, not even knowing that there was anything wrong with them. But then I started becoming a little more involved, and then pretty soon it became a... Someone says, you can't say that. I would say, oh, we can too.
Yeah, well, you were basically the only young guy with a platform at that time on primetime television.
We were, in hindsight, I can see what we were, the Smothers Brothers were pretty much, had no choice. We were young, the whole staff was basically young with some seasoned writers in there, but primarily was under 30, Rob Reiner, Steve Martin, Mason Williams, Bob Einstein, they all felt the same way as youth did. It was a great cultural clash, and we were there with a show, and we had to reflect that. It was just, I think it was a responsibility, even though I didn't think it then, but I perceive it now as that we had no choice.
But I still don't think you're giving yourself enough credit. To say that you had no choice and were sort of dragged along, or you were at the, you know, the fringes of this movement that we're carrying around anyway, is one thing. But you were, in terms of the rock and roll acts that you presented, the things that you brought on, the stuff that you discussed, going against the war, you basically were the center. And there's actually a clip that I'd like to play for you.
Okay.
That goes back from the old show, and this is basically November of 68, I think. Mm. And this is 2 weeks after you had the Beatles on to premiere Hey Jude and Revolution, which is not a shabby musical booking. And then you're lining up the acts for that week's show, and then this happens.
Tommy also has a special guest, too, and he'd like to introduce him right now.
That's right, I have a Beatle.
Yeah, but it's not the kind of Beatle you would expect it to be. It's the kind of Beatle that you, I think you hoped it would be. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. George Harrison. Hey, George. Do you have something important?
Something very important to say on American television.
You know, we don't have opportunity of saying anything important because it's American television. Every time you say something, they try to say something important, they clap, 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 clap.
Cue the lines. Well, whether you can say it or not, keep trying to say it.
That's what's important.
You get that? Yeah.
Yeah, see, now... What do you think about when you hear that?
I forget. It takes me back, yeah. Well, that was very nice. We were, and there was work. I'm not trying to diminish. There was just a lot of serendipity in the Smothers Brothers. A young had a number one, had a big show, happened to be during these very culturally kind of shake... earthquake, cultural earthquake, and social. And we were young enough, and all those things happened. I always just say we were at the scene of the accident, made the best of it we could, sorting stuff out, and we were very dedicated to putting out as much as we could possibly say, as expressing as much as we could through the sketches and everything. Like, God, I just, you know, you can't take credit for being at the, being born in America or being born somewhere else or wherever. So we were there. We did not shirk our duty to bring to television as intelligent and as interesting a show as we could. But I think circumstances really made a big difference, because if we'd have been had that show in the 50s or we had it in the 80s, it would have never had the impact, even if we'd have been diligently trying to do the most intelligent, thoughtful observations about life.
Well, we're gonna move further up in the decades, but I've got a couple more things I want to ask you about that time, one of which is perhaps your most famous act of defiance on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, which is breaking the blacklist on Pete Seeger and booking him. And was that a calculated effort on your part to sort of rail against the CBS censors?
I believe that was in 68, one of the last two seasons. And I did get more stubborn, more resolute in my need, and our crew and our writers wanted to express things, and it was more calculated. As a matter of fact, I said to all our guests that were ever guests on it, whether it be new groups or old groups or actors or comedians, I always say, you're our guest on our show, was there anything you'd like to do? And we'd like to present what you'd like to do. And Pete Seeger said, Waist Deep in the Big Muddy, and we sang at rehearsal, and I said, that's right on, and be my guest. And then the censors looked at it and says, veiled reflection on our policy in Vietnam. It wasn't very veiled. But I did purposely say, yes, that's good. They cut it out. We brought him back the next year, and I said, what would you like to sing? He says, Waist Deep in the Big Muddy. I said, well, be my guest this time, because it got so much publicity, and the word ugly word censorship was coming up, that they let it go. And it was the only show, I guess, that had a topical viewpoint about our involvement in Vietnam. It was a bad idea, and it was morally bankrupt, I thought, ethically wrong. But that consciousness came all over all of us in the process of doing this show.
Now, is it true? I don't know whether to believe you when I read this in print or not, but that you and Dick have actually attended brothers' therapy sessions?
When we were getting very near the end of our five-year, quote, our five-year plan, which is last year, he called me and he said he's been going to a lot of these group meetings, you know, like LifeSpring and other names for them. And he said, there are two people that I want to have a session with us. I think we work out some plans. It's the counselors. And I'm going, oh, no, not a, like a marriage counselor. He says, yeah, well, but not, they work with big corporations. They make personal and corporate breakthroughs, allowing people to function. Well, just talk about the Smothers Brothers. And I go, oh, man, I've never seen this work, you know. So I went with it, and these people came up. We had a very productive time. It cleared out a whole lot of things. And both Dick and I looked at each other and said, why didn't we do this 10 years ago, 15 years ago, or on a every two- or three-year basis, just to kind of clear the air, a third party who had no vested interest and could listen to us. Because we had legendary fights. Our fights were over timing and over material, and we are exact opposites, which is our little edge on stage, because we don't have to assume too much of a persona difference.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a 12-hour session, and people seemed to pick up on it. And we said we went to see a counselor to help our relationship get stronger. One time Dick said, isn't it difficult working with your brother about 35, 40 years like this? And he says, well, it's like an old marriage. A lot of fighting, no sex. I thought that's a funny line coming from the straight man.
Tom Smothers, recorded in 1997. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Tom Smothers, the driving force behind the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, which was yanked off CBS 30 years ago. I spoke with him in 1997. Okay, now that I've risked asking so many questions about the 60s, I want to go back even further just for a minute and just ask how you and your brother came to pick up the instruments that you did.
Well, my mother, our mother, Ruth Smothers, was always, when we were going back and forth to Grandma's house in the old Packard, we always sang songs. We always sang Down the Valley, Home on the Range, all these songs we'd be singing. And when I was about 7 years old, I just said, Mom, I wish I had a guitar. I want a guitar. And she got me a guitar, and I couldn't believe it. And I started learning to play it. Burl Ives was my first influence as far as musical about the guitar, and I wanted to be a band leader. Dick never played the instrument, was not interested. Then I saw, who was the guy? Little guy with the crew cut.
George Gobel?
George Gobel was my first comedic influence.
Hey, that's give me credit. That was a good one. Go ahead.
That was good.
Okay, go ahead.
You did draw that right out there. As you get older, you know the proper names go. But George Gobel was...
It was either him or Eisenhower. I just went for it. Go for it.
And I saw him on Ed Sullivan's show talking about losing a bowling ball. And I remember I was about 16 years old. I said, oh, wow, that's funny. Didn't tell a single joke, but I was laughing. And I said, boy, I'd like to do that. I thought it was being a monologist, giving a monologue. I didn't even know what it was. So I started doing stuff in high school. And I was playing in a band, a little dance combo. And I'd also MC things. And I had this kind of funny delivery that had some funny spaces in it. And I was dreadfully serious, and I'd get laughs all the time. So the instruments came in, and when we got to be seniors in high school, we were singing in quartets and choirs, and Dick was the best tenor in the South Bay area of Redondo Beach, where we went to finish up high school. And so he was in our trio, our quartet. And the Kingston Trio and Harry Belafonte started singing calypsos and folk songs, and we started singing those kind of songs, and the comedy just took over. And I kind of got waylaid musically because the comedy became our central focus. And the most unique thing that we did, it was a unique relationship. And didn't have to be the best, but had to be unique. That's important. I always say the Wright brothers' plane wasn't that good, actually. But it was sure original, wasn't it?
Well, I don't mean to get into another brothers' therapy session, but if Dick hadn't been the best tenor at Redondo Beach, would you have wanted your little brother in your band? Isn't that the age where it's kind of geeky to...
You're absolutely... You know, that's a great... I think when we were in high school, the only reason we started singing because he was the best tenor. He was really good. He sang really in tune. And we always argued doing rehearsals. I always wanted to rehearse a lot. We'd get in our car and we'd drive up, and the three of us in the car, Dick would drive and I'd be playing the guitar in the front seat and rehearsing harmonies and things. But I think the musical side of it, I got to know my brother very well. Without that, we'd have been kind of strangers, like sometimes it happens.
I have to ask you one last question, because TV critics carry around these bizarre factoids, and if I don't ask at these sorts of times, I'll never get to use them.
Okay.
There has not been a top 10 variety show on television in more than 20 years. Last one was the Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour in 73, 74. Do you think people would still watch one when the idea that you can get your music off of MTV or VH1, or you can get your comedy off of Comedy Central, would today's audiences stay put for an Ed Sullivan style or Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour style variety show in the late 90s?
Well, I think definitely they would, but... I mean, that's. I think that in this TV out there, we're switching. I think if we had something on Sunday nights, America on Stage, and it'd be a swift show, I think they would. But I think a variety show would go. But obviously no one else thinks that except you and me.
Well,
I mean, for the whole family to sit down and watch some very good stuff and juggling and tumbling and some... cutting-edge comics and stuff, that'd be great.
Well, in the meantime, you guys want to, like, call me every Sunday night, I'll keep my line open. Well, listen, I want you to thank you. I want to thank you for being part of the show here and giving us the hour. And for all the television you gave me and my generation. I mean, I'm not real super geeky here, but I'm definitely a fan, and I feel like you helped form my personality a little bit and my musical tastes and my politics. So thanks.
Well, thank you.
Tom Smothers, recorded in 1997. Tom and Dick Smothers continue to perform in concert and on TV. This is Fresh Air.